It's good to see everybody. We're going to pick up where we kind of left off. Still talking about the Old Testament, and particularly the context of the kings with the prophets and the association there too, so that we can kind of understand when we're reading the Bible how to read the Bible. Remember, this study has been a study on how to read the Bible and better understand its context. I'm trying to help here take away the approach where we just kind of open the Bible up and stick our finger down and go, okay, I'll start here. There is a system and a methodology to how to read the Bible. So that's what this class has been about. And May will be the last month for this quarter. Then we'll enter into the summer months, June, July, and August, where we do some special studies throughout those 3 months, give our teachers some breaks, do a little bit of special focus study upon or with the young men and the young women of the congregation, and the young ladies here will receive special attention from the elders' wives, and they will teach that class and kind of help guide the young ladies here. While we'll do some young men training throughout the summer and incorporate the young men. And that's what we've done for the last several years. It seems to work pretty good. Okay. Let's have a word of prayer and we'll begin our study. Evan, I'm going to pick on you again, sir. If Evan, you don't mind, lead us in prayer.
Let's all pray together. Most righteous Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for this beautiful day you've given, Father. The opportunity we've had to enjoy the breath of life and enjoy the day that's full of opportunities. And pray that we would take the opportunity we can to fulfill your will in our lives, Father, that you might be glorified. We especially thank this opportunity of study, Father, your marvelous word as we learn more and more about how to properly approach it, to hide it away in our hearts, and to live it out in our lives, Father. We pray that we sing your song to our precious name.
Amen. All right. So, we were talking about King Saul. Samuel, the last judge, first kind of like prophet in the Bible. And we're talking about 1 Samuel, the context of 1 Samuel. If you've been reading through the Bible, the Old Testament, you've come through the first 5 books of Moses. You've gone through the book of Joshua, which is the account of the conquering. The promised land is given. God's promise is fulfilled. Delivering Israel into the promised land and giving them that promised land. Joshua 21, Joshua 24. So the promised land is theirs. But they still have a fight. And Joshua, there should not be any misunderstanding that they still have a fight. And that fight is to continue to eradicate the idolatry of the idolaters in the land of Canaan. The Canaanites in particular, the Philistines, people like that. The Philistines will be a great nemesis to Saul, King Saul. And King Saul doesn't do too well. Do you remember the battle when King Saul is king, that David, king, little young David, takes on? Remember the guy's name? Yeah, Goliath. Yeah, 1 Samuel 17. And you start to see characters arise. You see comparisons. There's a reason why the Bible focuses upon these things. There's a stark contrast between the character of now Saul and then young David. Huge difference in character. And so we want to point those characteristics out because God wants us to learn about that. He wants us to see the differences and understand in part why would David become a man after God's own heart. But back to the book of Joshua. We've gotten through that book. We didn't spend a lot of time in the book of Judges. It's about 350 years of a dark period of time. They don't have a king over them. They're not doing well. Leadership seems to be failing on all fronts. And the book of Judges ends with these words in the last verse of the book of Judges, Judges 21, verse 25. And it says, there in those days, this is significant. It's why I want to point out again the study, the emphasis upon kings and so forth. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Now, I've studied the Bible for years, you know, consistently for, I don't know how long, what am I now? 30 years or so. And that passage means a lot more to me today in Judges. And we've talked about that. Why does that passage mean a lot more to me today? What's the lesson I have learned? And I'm asking you to remember what we've talked about. What have I learned personally from that passage in Judges 21, verse 25? Will God give them a king? He sure will. And he said in Deuteronomy 17, almost 400 years, 450 years before that passage is recorded, Moses said in Deuteronomy 17, before he dies, you're going to ask for a king in the days that you come into the promised land, but we don't know when. We don't know how long it's going to take. And here we get it. We're starting to learn. And we keep reading the book of Ruth. Ruth pops in. I wonder how many people that don't know the story of the Bible or why it's there, why the book of Ruth is in there. So key off of that passage there in Judges 21:25, key on that passage, there was no king. And then you start reading the book of Ruth. How many of you start reading the book of Ruth and go, I don't even know what this is talking about. What's Judges 21:25? What does that have to do with the four chapters in the book of Ruth? How many of you might know that answer? I know the answer now. It's really not about Ruth. It's not about Boaz. It's not about Naomi or her two sons and her husband who die in the land of, you remember where? Moab. It's not about them. That's not what that story's about. Yeah, look at the last four verses the last five verses of Ruth. The reason the book of Ruth is in the Bible is to key off of Judges 21:25. Look at it. What do those four verses tell us is about to happen? And it's a summary. It's not a long, lengthy, detailed story about all the bad things that is happening during the days of Ruth. Naomi's, what does she say to call her when she comes out of Moab and returns back home? Which means bitter. She's a bitter woman. Is that what I'm to learn about? Well, there's a story in that. We could talk about Naomi. I mean, we'd be bitter too if, or not maybe me, but a woman would be bitter if her husband drug her off into Moab, took her away from her home, took her from her people, her family. You have two sons and a husband that die in a foreign land. How would you feel? Potentially bitter? But the story's about Ruth, a Moabitish woman who finds herself, remember I asked the question, Judges 21:25, what does that passage mean to me today? It means this, in Matthew chapter 1, how'd you get that connection, Brian? Well, I kept reading and I got to Ruth chapter 4 and I saw where the story of Ruth is about a man named Jesse, actually, in verse 22. Whose great-great-grandfather is Boaz. That's the connection. And Jesse happens to be the father of whom? David. And we're not even talking about King Saul here. We're talking about David already. King Saul, he's not even part of the story here really. King Saul will become more or less of a subcategory on why you don't want to act like him or practice his characteristics. Because it won't end well for him or his son Jonathan. But back to, again, this story. I'm still keying on that one passage in Judges 21:25 going, there was no king in those days. That's interesting. Well, I read the four chapters of Ruth and I come to, oh, I know about this guy named Jesse and David. But we're not going to learn about David until later in the book of Samuel. We've got to get through Saul, get him kicked off first. But like I said, this passage in Judges 21:25 is not about really King David. It's really about a Moabitish woman in one sense that God in some senses redeems, named Ruth, who ends up in the genealogy of the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, who is Christ. Isn't that what Matthew chapter 1 is about? And this whole story and what we're learning in the Old Testament is, a synopsis, a summary of what the perfect king is going to look like. God's going to allow us, though, to see and experience these guys and all the miserable failures and all the consequences. And I've been thinking about this a lot since this study kind of kicked off in my mind. Always learning, growing in the grace and knowledge, right? 2 Peter 3:18. Commanded to do so. Okay, so here I am, early 50s, and I'm thinking through this, and I'm thinking, wow. And I'm looking at a refresh of all the consequences of Saul. The choices that he made and the consequences. And then I'm already in my mind, I've been working through this study, I'm into David in my mind already. A man after God's own heart. I mean, Jesus is called the son of David, right? Son of man, son of David, son of God. And I think about David and Saul, and we're going to contrast them a little bit more here. Look at the choices those two guys will make in their life and then the consequences, the results. Did it affect their families? Did it affect the nations, their bad choices? For bad? Did David struggle with bad choices in his family? Effect upon his children, effect upon, again, long-term effects. And it dawned on me again, and I'm reminded of something. The choices that Jesus made in his life. All the choices that that king, our perfect king, made. What are the consequences of his choices? You see where I'm going with this? What choices will Jesus make that negatively impact my life? Did Jesus make any bad choices? Sinful choices? And then I start to ask myself the question, look at the choices that he made in his life and look at the consequences of those choices, the impact, and look at how good my life is because he straightened all this up. He cleaned it up. And he's the only one that could. He's the Redeemer. And now I know why I preach redemption more for people. I'm trying to help people. I'm trying to help them see that you can do better. I can do better. Because I have Jesus. And that's really the lessons that we have to see when we read through the Old Testament. But they're here for our learning. Romans 15:4. Whatsoever things written for him, written for our learning. That we through patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope. And I need that hope, don't you? Boy, aren't you glad you got the New Testament. And what if we only had the Old Testament? And I think about that. What did the Jews look? Did they like King David, the Jews? During the days of Jesus, they liked King David, liked to honor him. Anybody remember what Peter would preach on the day of Pentecost, Acts chapter 2, about the sepulcher of David, his tomb? He says, well, David's sepulcher is right here. And guess what? His bones are still in there. Isn't that interesting? About 1,000 years later, I'm taking his words literal to be true. But the apostle Peter on the day of Pentecost, Acts 2 about verse 22, 23, he says, David's sepulcher is right here and his bones are still in that sepulcher. Jesus' tomb's right over there, the son of David. And that tomb that's empty. So who do you want to serve? You want to hold on to your King David? You want to hold on and honor him? Or would you rather look to the King Christ and say, hey, he lives. He's not dead. He's alive. So that's the lessons. And so I have to again draw our attentions to that so that we don't only focus on failures. We have to see this in view of Christ. So in 1 Samuel chapter 12, I was showing you, remember 1 Samuel chapter 8 is very significant. That's where they asked for a king. And in 1 Samuel chapter 8, God says, give them a king, Samuel. They have not rejected you, they've rejected me, that I should reign over them, indicating that he was already reigning over them. They just didn't identify it. And so God will give them a king. And in this context, Saul will be chosen in the first 1 Samuel 9 through 10. Saul's a good-looking man. He's got the physical appearance. But what does that have to do with the character of a man? In fact, when we get to David and they're trying to find David, isn't there a passage that says something about God doesn't look upon the outward appearance, doesn't judge like a man, looks to Jesse and says, don't you have a younger son? I'd like to see him. Bring him to me. And in comes David, little shepherd boy, and that's who will be chosen. So we're learning lessons here. 1 Samuel chapter 9 and 10, you get Saul chosen. 1 Samuel 12, we read this last time, and it's Samuel's farewell speech and his more or less rebuke, and reminds the Israelites of their failures. But he tells them in 1 Samuel 12, verse 14, verse 15, that if you will fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice, not the king, not this King Saul necessarily, but the Lord, and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then shall both ye and also the king, he's got to do this too, that reigneth over you, continuing to follow the Lord your God. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then shall the hand of the Lord be against you as it was against your fathers. And so Samuel's preparing to die. 1 Samuel chapter 13, we get to the first failure of Saul. Let's look at this for just a moment, verses 8 through 14. Verses 8 through 14, we alluded to this. Let's look at it a little bit closer tonight. 1 Samuel 13, verse 8 through 14. Can I get a reader for this? You don't mind? Yes, please do, Daniel. 13. Yeah, chapter 13, verses 8 through 14. A little lengthy reading, but read that for us, please.
And he tarried 7 days according to the set time that Samuel had appointed. But Samuel came not to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. Saul said, bring hither a burnt offering to me, and a peace offering, and offer the burnt offering. And it came to pass that as soon as he made an end of offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him, that he might salute him. And Samuel said, what hast thou done? And Saul said, because I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that thou camest not when the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered themselves together in Michmash, therefore said I, the Philistines have come down now upon me to Gilgal, and I have not made supplication unto the Lord. I forced myself, therefore, and offered a burnt offering. And Samuel said to Saul, thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandments of the Lord thy God, which he commanded thee. For now the Lord hath established thy kingdom upon Israel forever. And now thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord hath sought him a man after his own heart, and the Lord hath commanded him to be captain of his people, because thou hast not kept that which the Lord commanded thee.
So that verse, thank you, that verse 12 says it all. What did Saul say to Samuel? Yeah. I messed up. I forced myself. I just, you know, couldn't wait any longer. I think Mike mentioned last Sunday the Psalms. David writes a lot of the Psalms, King David. And a phrase is found in the Psalms over and over again. Can you recall what that phrase is Mike referred to? Wait on the Lord. Wait on the Lord. Look that up and just consider the importance of being patient, waiting on the Lord. We want to force a lot of things Some would argue that, well, he was just wanting to do what's right and sacrifice burnt offerings unto the Lord and, I guess, force the blessings of God. All right, that doesn't go too well for him. Let's look at chapter 15 now. Anybody remember the great failure in chapter 15? This is the failure at with the Amalekites. And he's instructed in verses 1 and following to continue, again, waging war. Remember the book of Joshua. What were they supposed to continue doing in the land of promise? Driving out these wicked idolaters. What do wicked idolaters do to the culture if we don't drive them out? Yeah. On your families. You've got to drive this out of your families. You've got to know what idolatry looks like today. And they became allies with them. They became friends with them. And Samuel says, you've got to utterly destroy these Amalekites. And that's the instruction in verse 3, chapter 15. So Saul begins to gather the people and numbered them. Which is interesting. Anybody remember who gets in trouble for numbering the people of God? Yeah, David will get in trouble for numbering the people, which is an interesting story in the Bible. Again, it's an indicator. Whose strength are we relying upon? Our numbers or the strength of the Lord? You know who I enjoy preaching for and to more than anybody, anything else? I really enjoy going to do a gospel meeting for about 25, 30, 40 people maybe. That are starving and hungering and thirsting for righteousness. I enjoy that. So I'd rather go preach to a small group of people than 500,000 people. I'll get to that one day maybe, but right now I enjoy the people that are hungering and thirsting. I'm not worried about numbers, I'm worried about faith. And that's what God is looking for. So again, he's numbering the people. And he doesn't do his job. So it says they laid in wait, the valley, verse 5, verse 6, Saul said to the Kenites, go depart, get down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them, for you showed kindness to all the children of Israel when they came up out of Egypt. So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. Characteristic of David, or Saul, I mean, seems like kind of a just man here. And so in verse 7, he smote Amalekites and from Havilah unto Shur. Over against Egypt. He took Agag, the king, alive, utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword, but he keeps the king. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, of the oxen, fatlings, lambs, all that was good, and would not utterly destroy them, but everything that was vile and refuse, they destroyed utterly. Now, who made that judgment in verse 9? Everything that was vile and refuse. Saul did. And by keeping the spoil, the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, all of that, what was that? What did that represent in this day and age? Still does today, but we call that live stock. Why is it called live stock? It's a living stock. And stock means what? How many of you own stock shares in the stock market? Yeah. Yeah. It's based upon psychology. It's based upon, you know, profitability of companies and so forth. And this is livestock. And so this type of, they didn't have Wall Street, you know, here anyway. They may have had some kind of a market, but it wasn't Wall Street. So that's the value. They wanted to keep that. That represents, again, wealth. And King Agag still kind of baffles me to this day. Usually you wipe out the leadership. During the days of the Babylonians taking the Israelites of the southern kingdom, and Zedekiah and the last kings, are they spared? Or who do you see spared in the book of Daniel chapter 1? your officials, your leaders, aren't really the ones that are spared usually. They're the ones that are wiped out. But they'll spare like the young people. And so what was Daniel? What did he represent? Youth. Yeah, okay, young, energetic ones, maybe ones we can indoctrinate and cult, you know. So, I find it interesting that if you read into our own American history, the American Indians, they robbed, stole, and pillaged other tribes, and even settlers and, you know, Europeans here in this state especially. And they never keep alive the adults or the equal warriors or so forth. But they'll take the children a lot of time. And they didn't necessarily, keep the babies. They killed the babies. Why would they kill the babies, Indians? Say that again? Okay, useless. Yeah, I mean, it's too much trouble. They just kill them. But now you take your 9-year-olds up to your 12-year-old young boys and girls, guess what they did with those young people? Yeah. Read the story of Herman Lehman, the young boy that was over here out of Mason, Texas, who was stolen, taken captive, whooped, I mean, beaten pretty bad, but becomes a indoctrinated Comanche. And he goes to fighting with them and wars against the Texas Rangers, and there's an interesting story, and he's eventually brought back out, but Herman Lehman is an interesting story to read. So with that said, back to King Saul and the Amalekites. He keeps the king and destroys everything else that's vile except the valuable livestock and so forth. And listen to these words, verse 10 and following. Came the word of the Lord unto Samuel. And you might want to sometime do a study of that phrase. The word of the Lord in the Old Testament. The word of the Lord is a very significant term in the entire Old Testament. All right? When you see that phrase, that's a reference of inspiration from heaven. But came unto Samuel, saying, "It repenteth me that I have set up Saul to be king, for he has turned back from following me." This is God's view. Remember, man doesn't think like God thinks. Isaiah says that man's thoughts are not God's thoughts. These are God's thoughts right here. This is the way God viewed Saul. Doesn't matter what you or I think about Saul. This is how God viewed Saul. And this is the word of the Lord saying it. And so when he says, "He turned back from following me," that's the way God sees it. "Hath not performed my commandments." What's Saul going to say here in just a moment to that statement? He's going to argue with the Lord. He's going to say, "Oh, I have." And he's going to get corrected. "And it grieved Samuel, and he cried unto the Lord all night." He's not happy. I mean, this is very difficult. Remember, this is the same Samuel in 1 Samuel 8 that was very upset that the leaders of Israel came to him and said, "Make us a king like all the other nations, for your sons are corrupt." And they were. But it still wasn't, again, the desire of God, because God tells Samuel, "They have not rejected you, but they have in fact rejected me." So there's a rejection going on here. We need to think about that when we make our choices in life today as Christians. As bad as life may be around us, as bad as politics could be, as corrupt as it may be, the Christian always has a king. And he's never rejected us unless we reject him. And so these are some good lessons and strong lessons for us to learn. So again, the Lord, it's a tough deal. Samuel cries all night. Verse 12, "And when Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning," I doubt he slept much, "it was told Samuel, saying, Saul came to Carmel. And behold, he set him up a place and has gone about and passed on and gone down to Gilgal. And Samuel said to Saul," And Saul said unto him, Blessed be thou of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord. Now stop there for just a moment. Do you remember the words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 7? Behold, many will say unto me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name? And in thy name done many wonderful works. Matthew 7, 21 through 23. And the Lord tells us before he closes out that discourse, the Sermon on the Mount, and he tells us, I'll say unto them, Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. That's the same principle right here. And that's the Lord Jesus Christ speaking. And Saul will say here, Oh, I have performed the commandment of the Lord. I've killed everything. We've wiped out all the vile. And Samuel said, What meaneth then the bleating of the sheep in mine ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? And Saul said, They have brought them from the Amalekite. For the people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice unto the Lord. Let's justify this. We're going to take all this wealth, all this money, and we're going to do all this good for the Lord. I think sometimes people today think that money and wealth glorifies the Lord. Is that true or false? Now, it matters what you do with your money and wealth. Don't misunderstand the two different statements. But it's Jesus that says that it's hard for a rich man to pass through the eye of the needle, camel's eye. It's a principle. It's Paul that writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6, and he says, money or gold is not the root of all evil, it's the love of it. And many people fall into a snare and a trap of that money and that wealth, and it brings about many hurtful problems in life. The more you possess, I remember a man said, the more I have, the more miserable I am. I feel that way sometimes. Gene and I talk about just selling it all. And that's no joke. It's, you know, it's...
Yeah. Taxes, repairs, everything.
Taxes, repairs, yeah. Things break all the time. Dilapidation, where rust and moth doth corrupt. Yeah, exactly. And so, but here, you know, the attitude is hey, you know, it's probably the same attitude. Let's build a big fancy temple and that's what will glorify God. That's not what glorifies God. And so, answer is in verse 16. Samuel said unto Saul, Stay, and I will tell thee what the Lord hath said to me this night. And he said unto him, Say on. And Samuel said, When thou wast little in thine own sight, wast thou not made the head of the tribes of Israel? And the Lord anointed thee king over Israel. And the Lord sent thee on a journey and said, Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they be consumed. Wherefore then didst thou not obey the voice of the Lord? There's that phrase again, the voice of the Lord. But didst fly upon the spoil and didst evil in the sight of the Lord. You like that spoil. That's what he's saying there. You saw that spoil. You recognize those fatlings. Who doesn't like a good barbecue? I'm not barbecuing skinny, grass-fed beef. I'm going after the fat, marbled stuff because I know that fat carries the flavor. I know what I'm looking for, but I ain't talking about sacrificing here. I'm talking about a brisket. This is a different culture. All right. And so that statement there, you fly upon the spoil, you saw exactly what you wanted, and you took it. And Saul said unto Samuel, Yea, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and have gone the way which the Lord sent me and have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. What? But the people, yeah. But the people took of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the chief of the things which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice unto the Lord thy God in Gilgal. That's not a real good excuse either. It's kind of like saying, a general saying, I lost the battle because these people stink you gave me. Well, what's your job, general? Before you go into war, what's your job? You need to get your soldiers in. That was your brigade or your division. That was your job. Don't make up those excuses. Samuel said, verse 22, here's a great principle. What's the Lord? I'll just ask it in the reverse. What does the Lord delight in? It tells us what he doesn't delight in. He delights in the obedience of the heart. Romans 6:17. People struggle with obedience as if it's a meritorious thing. Well, I suppose if you obeyed a command just because you had to do it or you begrudged doing it, if we gave every Sunday morning as we're instructed to give with a begrudging heart, you think that's going to amount to a hill of beans with the Lord? No, but I have to obey it. Romans 6:17 is the passage that helps you understand the key to obedience. And Paul says to those at Rome, God be thanked but that ye have obeyed from the heart this form of doctrine that was delivered unto you. So why are you here again? Why are you a Christian? Is it because you're just so scared you're going to go to hell that you... Or is it because you're obeying from the heart this form of doctrine? This passage right here says everything about King Saul. And it also will tell us everything about King David. King David did things because his heart. And that's why you have the statement over and over again that David was a man after God's own heart. David will make some very terrible mistakes in his life because he struggles with temptation. That's true. But what does David do every time he struggles with temptation? Does he act like Saul here? Did he accept his consequences? Yeah, I mean, when he has the adulterous affair with Bathsheba and that child is lost, what does he do when he mourns over that child? This is David, a man after God's own heart. He says, I cannot bring that child back. And he quits mourning when they tell him. He rises up and he says, but I can go to him, that child. Now tell me, what kind of a person is that that sees life that way? That understands life that way? Most people are afraid to let go. In that sense, David knew he was in trouble. He knew he had caused the pain and the suffering. Go read Psalm 51. Against thee and thee only have I sinned. He doesn't even blame it on Bathsheba. We'll probably wonder till the day we die, man, why the lady was bathing naked out in the public. She was visible. But David will say, against thee and thee only have I sinned. He owns it. And he'll suffer consequences. He'll suffer hurt. Read the story of his ending life. It's not a pretty picture. You want to learn those lessons. Again, Jesus didn't make those kinds of mistakes. He didn't leave us a family that's full of incest and murder and bitterness and jealousy. He didn't leave us with that. He left us with the perfect family called the house of God, the church of Christ. And I love that family.
I just wanted to add to that obedience point that I don't think many would disagree that obedience is necessary.
That's right.
What we find here is obedience is in the details. We can find ourselves in the same boat as sin. I did it, but obedience is in the details. God is very specific in the details.
That's right. How many people with that statement in mind are arguing over the details of the church?
How many people with that in mind say God knows my heart?
Yeah, there you go.
So God knows. In essence, they're saying the details doesn't matter.
That's right.
I don't necessarily have to do that if my intentions were good.
That's right. Are there details? Are there definitions that we can understand? Anybody confused in here about the plan of salvation? Can I help you understand that clearly so that you're not confused or you're making statements like, God just knows my heart? That is kind of the attitude of a King Saul, if you look at it. That's his attitude. How many people today claim to love the Lord, but they don't do what he says? Jesus said that in Luke 6. Why call you me Lord, Lord? Verse 46, and not do the things which I say. John 15, Mike's been talking about that context. That's talking about friendship. How valuable is friendship as defined in the Bible? Do you know why? That's why I protect my heart. I have to protect my heart because friendship is based upon the love of Christ. And that love isn't cheap. You are my friends if you do what I say. That's the definition of real friendship, Christianity. And, you know, it takes time. Yes, ma'am.
Love has to precede that because that's why he says the greatest commandment is this, that you love the Lord your God and then you love your neighbor as yourself. I can't even command another person or if in the sense of that context of friendship, I wouldn't even dare to if I didn't love God first and love myself enough properly to love a friend. Because I'm not going to ask them to do anything that is going to violate their soul or mine or to put them in harm's way.
That's right. So if I've got one friend and I know that friend is Jesus, I've got all the friends I need, to be honest with you. And he's my most important friend. You know, a husband can't even love his wife really correctly if he doesn't love Jesus first. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and so gave himself for her. Well, that's a tough love. So I can tell you why right now why marriages fail all the time. I don't even have to do a marriage counseling ceremony. There's a problem with love somewhere. Well, we'll sit down and talk about it and try to study the Bible, but I've got to introduce them to Jesus and the love. And so we can look at people like Saul and we can see the failures. And Saul, in 1 Samuel 28, he will consult, according to the King James Bible, a witch of Endor. What kind of a dilapidated characteristic do you have to become? Paranoid fixture, conspiratorial dude. How far has King Saul come by the time we get to 1 Samuel chapter 28? I mean, yeah, look at verse 9. I'll stop right here. When she's over here doing her witchcraft, verse 9, and the woman said unto him, behold, thou knowest what Saul hath done, how he hath cut off those that have familiar spirits and wizards. And verse 11, then said the woman, whom shall I bring up unto thee? And he said, bring me up Samuel. Y'all remember the story? Look at verse 15. Now, did this witch do this or did the Lord allow this? Wow. Yeah, the Lord. Samuel said, by the way, I am the God of the living, not the dead. Samuel, is he alive or dead here? Samuel said to Saul, why hast thou disquieted me to bring me up? And Saul answered, I am sore distressed, for the Philistines make war against me, and God has departed from me, and answereth me no more, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I have called thee, that thou mayest make known unto me what I shall do. Then said Samuel, wherefore then dost thou ask of me, seeing the Lord has departed from thee, and has become thine enemy? And the Lord hath done to him as he spake by me, for the Lord hath rent the kingdom out of thine hand, and even it to thy neighbor, even to David. Because thou, what's it say in verse 18? All right. So, Verse 20, Saul fell straightway all along the earth and was sore afraid because of the words of Samuel, and there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no bread all day. So, very interesting story, very interesting lessons. In chapter 31, he loses his army. The Philistines are going to triumph over him. His dead body is going to be desecrated, basically. And the sad part about this is a man named Jonathan, if you ask me. What kind of a person was Jonathan?
Soldier.
Did he love David? They were very close, very knit. And yet, will he be loyal to his dad? Jonathan, toward the end, he dies in battle. Yeah, that's what I mean. And will he mourn over Saul and Jonathan? A man that tried to kill him. King Saul tried to kill David. I mean, how many times could David have killed Saul? He cut off a piece of his clothing and said, I could have killed you, man. You know, he's like, just leave me alone. Anyway, all right, we're going to keep studying through this until we get to the end of the story.
So, there had to be some pity.